The Ku Klux Klan was once a powerful force in this country. In the 1920s, at its peak, it controlled many political offices, including a firm grip on the Oregon legislature for a few years. By the 1980s, the Klan was much less of a force for white supremacy, but it was a force just the same. And a lawsuit helped cripple the Klan, a suit filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center under Morris Dees. The lawsuit and what led to it are the focus of the book The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. Loris Lemer is the author. He's well-traveled and well-read in both senses of the word. He served in the Peace Corps in Nepal and worked in a factory in France, to name a couple of places. Lawrence is the author of more than a dozen books, several of which ended up on the New York Times bestseller lists. And he wrote a play, Rose, that was produced off-Broadway last year. Loris Lemer, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks, Jeff.
There's plenty of uplift in this book eventually, but also lots of revulsion and outrage. What drew you to this subject matter?
Well, I'd written a book called The Price of Justice about these two Pittsburgh lawyers and their fight against Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey Energy, who thank goodness is going to jail for prison for a year, or should it be longer. When I finished that, I sent it out to get blurbs from people. You know, you try to find these famous people that say nice things about your book, and Morris, I sent it to Morris Dees. Frankly, I didn't even know if he was still alive. I knew he was a famous name and all. And I sent it to him, and he called and said he gave me a great blurb, and he said, I've had this story, it's been sitting there forever, lots of people wanted to write it, and I never felt anybody was the right one to do it, but if you want to do it, I'll cooperate with you, and I won't have any control over you, you can just do what you want, and he's a man of his word.
So the lynching itself, Michael Donald, a young man in Mobile, Alabama in 1981, give us a sense of how shocking a lynching was in that time and place.
Well, from 1870 to 1955, there was an average of about a lynching a week through the South. And psychologically, imagine how devastating that was, so many of them, for African Americans. If you're a black mother, how do you raise your son? Do you raise him to stand up and walk bold, or do you raise him when he sees a white man coming to get off the sidewalk and dump his hat? Probably the latter if you want him to stay alive. And so the fear of lynching was very much in the black soul in the South. It's there. It's there. It's still there now, really. But so 1955. In March 1981, dawn, a Saturday morning, people wake up and they're on Herndon Avenue in downtown Mobile. It's a black body hanging from a rope on a tree. Now, black people showed up. They started crying. They got down on their hands and knees. They pounded their fists against the cement. They cried hysterically. They knew it was a lynching. Nobody had to tell them that this was a racial lynching. They knew automatically. But the Mobile establishment, they thought of Mobile as this pristine city. It wasn't like Birmingham or Montgomery that had a bad reputation for racial matters. Mobile was different. They couldn't abide the idea of a lynching having taken place in their city. So, a few days later, these three young men, these Cajuns, they were probably drug dealers, but they were arrested for this crime, a crime they didn't commit. They could have gone to prison. They could have died for this. And they were, but thank goodness, they went before a grand jury. Most grand juries, they just rubber stamp what the prosecutor wants. But these good citizens listened carefully, and they knew this was not right, and they refused to give an indictment. And so those three young men were free, but that didn't mean that they were going to find the murderers. No, nobody in the Mobile was going to do it. So the federal government came in, the Justice Department came in the presence of Barry Kowalski, a young Civil Rights Division attorney from Washington D.C. came down, and he worked with Thomas Figures, who was a black assistant U.S. attorney in Mobile, and a FBI agent. And they found the killers.
So give us an idea of what Michael Donald's involvement was. He really was just totally the random person in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Michael Donald was a 19-year-old young man. He was the youngest of nine children. He was living with his mother. He worked part-time in folding newspapers in downtown in the paper. He was studying to be a brick mason. You know, he was kept loved a clean life. That evening, his aunt about 11 o'clock, ran out of cigarettes, and she gave Michael a dollar, and asked him to go out and get cigarettes. That's what he was doing. Three or four days before, the Klan had had a meeting outside of Mobile. There had been a bank robber in Birmingham, a black bank robber, robbed a bank. When he came out, he was trying to escape. When he was escaping, he shot and killed a white police officer. He was a very controversial man, as you can imagine. And to give this guy a fair trial, they brought it down to Mobile, and it was heard before a largely black jury. So at the Klan meeting, they decided that if this guy got off for murdering this white cop, they would go out and kill a black man in retribution. That Friday evening, after hours of deliberation, the verdict, they couldn't reach a verdict, so it was a hung jury. And so out, these two Klansmen, a 17-year-old, imagine, Tiger Nose is only 17 years old, and 25-year-old Henry Hayes go out looking for a black man. They go into a black neighborhood. They see a black man, you know, elderly black gentleman trying to use a pay phone, but that was too far away. And then they saw Michael walking along the street. They drew up next to him. Knowles pulls out a gun and forces him to get in the back seat of the car. They drive way out in the countryside in this remote area next to a dump. Get him out of there. He knows. He's a grew up in the South. He's black. He knows what these guys are going to do to him. And he tries to fight back. And they bludgeon him. They basically bludgeon him to death. They beat him to death. And they put half to death. And then they put the rope, go in the trunk and get the rope. And they pull the rope tight around his neck and strangle him to death. And then to make sure, they cut his throat. Now they could have put, and so then they bring him back to Mobile and hang him from a tree.
Yeah, it's almost, it would be comical if it weren't involving the death of a human being, but the fact that they couldn't find a tree tall enough and do things with the rope right, and it just, anyway, it sure looked like a lynching, as you point out, to people in Mobile, and so the aftermath of that is what led up to this lawsuit against the Ku Klux Klan that becomes one of the major forces in the book. It's called The Lynching. Lawrence Leamer is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to The Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lawrence Leamer, the author of several books. His latest is called The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. It's about a lawsuit filed by Morris Dees at the Southern Poverty Law Center against the United Klans of America, and the result that it ended up crippling the Klan. All started with a lynching in Mobile, Alabama in 1981 of Michael Donald. You can join us on The Exchange as we discuss a lot of the issues surrounding both the Klan and white supremacy and the whole ball of wax there. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. There's an early reference in the book, Lawrence, to Klan members on the police force. How great was the presence within the police at that time in Mobile?
Betty is an outside investigator, and it came down there. An interesting story to tell. He grew up in a part of Alabama that had very few black people, and he took a boat ride across to another county, and there was a billboard said using the N-word and say, don't get out of our county before dusk. And that is not apocryphal. That was there. It's written about in several books in the New York Times. So that's the kind of climate. He came down there, and he thought four of the five white police detectives were racist. And he heard them use the N-word in the police station with the black officer just the other side of the partition where he could hear what was being said.
Wow. I want to get into some depth with the people involved here, because you draw the characters very, very fully in the book. Michael Donald, you mentioned he had a clean life. Talk about his family, though. It sounds like a very close and supportive family.
Yeah, I mean, the mother, the father was a kind of troubled guy who left her. She brought up the seven children. She was, on welfare for much of this, but she was a wonderful mother. All the children did, they all had good lives. They all had decent jobs. and she was just so proud of her family. And Malcolm the youngest was really the favorite, and she thought that she anticipated he would have a good life, and he would have if he hadn't gone out for cigarettes that day.
So contrast this with Benny Jack Hayes and his family. He sounds like a total psychopath, and he just ruled his family with an iron fist from the way you write it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Klan leader. This is the Klan leader in the southern half of the state. He actually was a Catholic. He's a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And Catholics, you know, in the 20s, the Klan was more anti-Catholic than it was anti-black. And so I guess it's a measure of how desperate the Klan was getting that they would have a Catholic Klan member, a Catholic leader. He started out, he was semi-illiterate. He beat his children. His former sister-in-law says that he beat her because she would not have sex with him. He just was one unpleasant piece of work. And his son, Henry, he just everything his son did, he didn't like. And he tried to set an example to him. He had a dog called White Hope that would get out from the yard. And one day, Benny Hay just cut the paws, the dog's paws. And when his son watched, and his son started crying, and he thought his son was a sissy because he cried. That's the kind of evil guy this was. And he's the one that instigated and pushed his son. And the reason his son committed the murder is to prove himself a man to his father.
Wow, that's a really weird kind of dynamic there. And so it's Henry Hayes and Tiger Knowles were the two men who actually killed Michael Donald. And again, in response to the, they were looking for somebody in the black community to kill. After a jury could not reach a verdict on a black man killing a white guard at a bank in a bank robbery, was it clear to police right away? I mean, you mentioned the black community knew right away that this was a lynching. Did the police have it? Did they think that it was a Klan thing, or were they determined not to think it was a Klan thing?
They were determined not to think it was a Klan thing. I mean, listen, this Michael Figures, who was a black politician, a black state senator, the leading kind of black politician in the southern half of the state, and a lawyer. He arrived that Saturday morning. He took a picture of the body hanging in the tree, and he turned around, and he took a picture across the street of three men standing there, leaning on a car. The three men were Benny Hayes, the Klan leader in the southern half of the state, his son Henry, and Tiger Knowles, the two murderers.
Wow. So you mentioned the fact that the three people got arrested in short order who had nothing to do with the case, and the grand jury wouldn't even indict them. Was this just to look for somebody to make it look good? I mean, or did they honestly believe they had the right people?
I can't believe they thought they had the right people. I mean, they had no evidence. I mean, the grand jury wouldn't give an indictment. It shows what they were trying to do here. It really was despicable.
Michael's family, and we're talking his mom, Beulah Mae Donald, and his siblings, met with the DA in Mobile. So what happened?
Well, they kept trying. None of them went to the DA, but they went downtown. About 10 of them, the whole family, goes downtown and starts knocking on lawyers' offices, trying to get a lawyer to take this case. They couldn't get a single lawyer in the entire city to take it. The lawyers didn't want to touch it.
So this was a highly publicized case nationally. I mean, obviously anything that's going to be, the first lynching in 26 years in Alabama is going to be a news story, not just in Alabama. What was the response on a national level?
Well, first of all, you know, we hear this talk about states' rights. We can't violate states' rights. Well, if that rhetoric had been successful, Michael Donald's killers never would have been found. It took the federal government, in the presence of Barry Kowalski, a lawyer in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, to come down there and work with Thomas Figures, Michael Figures' brother, who was an assistant U.S. attorney there, and James Bodman, an FBI agent, to find these killers.
So the witnesses end up talking to a federal grand jury, and there's a really well-drawn scene here where Benny Jack Hayes, the father of one of the killers, is sitting in the courthouse. What's he doing?
He's intimidating these Klansmen that are being called before the jury. The feds, what their idea is just to they set this grand jury, and they can do it where the states can't do it, because it's an expensive thing to do, to keep this grand jury going on week after week after week, and hauling people in front to talk to the grand jury, and bring them back two or three times, sometimes, whatever, to get the truth out of them. And during this process, Benny Hayes just sits there. He just doesn't say anything. He just sits there in the corridor, watching the people go by that are going to testify.
So ultimately, what charges did Henry Hayes and Tiger Knowles face, and what stories did they tell?
Well, Tiger Knowles, didn't want to die. He didn't want to face the death penalty, so he pled guilty to a civil rights violation that in the end got him a life imprisonment. He ended up serving 25 years, and I interviewed him. He's out now. Believe it or not, he's a kosher chef. Chef, that's what he is.
A kosher chef?
Not Jewish. He's not Jewish, but kosher chef.
Wow. And so he was the one who then gave enough evidence to allow the conviction of Henry Hayes?
Yeah, and then Henry Hayes went. And it's funny because, Deez is really... is concerned with justice, whatever it is, and a colorblind justice. And in that courtroom, he sat there in the courtroom during Henry Hayes' trial, and the jury found him guilty. And then in the Alabama justice system at that time, you decide of guilt, and if it's guilty, then the jury goes back and decides the penalty. Then there are two choices: either life in prison without parole, or execution in the electric chair. And the jury decided that they wanted him to be sentenced to life imprisonment. End of that. But then a couple months later, it comes up before the judge. And almost always, the judge goes along with what the jury has decided. And in this case, even in the courtroom itself, capital murder in Alabama. Okay, if you're going to be found guilty of capital murder, you have to have committed a crime, a felony, when you're committing the murder. It's not just enough to murder somebody. Well, what was the felony? When they were driving out in the car to murder Michael Donald, Tiger Knowles asked Michael Donald to take his wallet out. He takes his wallet out and puts it in the car. The wallet then is found a couple of days later in a dumpster, and the dollar is gone. Well, Henry Hayes didn't have anything to do with that. And what was it, a robbery? Who knows if it was a robbery? Maybe somebody just found that dollar, just took the dollar on the dumpster. But they used that wrongly to what Morris D. says is a judicial lynching to find him guilty of capital murder. In other words, it just wasn't a fair charge. This is an evil guy, did an evil act. He deserved to be punished terribly and sentenced to years, many years in prison, but that wasn't the charge it should be. Anyway, he's found guilty of that, and then the judge goes back and changes the sentence and sentences him to die in the electric chair. Because at that point, the Mobile establishment wanted to show that they weren't racist. All the national publicity was on this thing, and they thought, well, we're going to execute this guy. That's the best thing to do.
We're talking about Mobile, Alabama in the early 80s. The book is called The Lynching, the Epic Courtroom Battle That Brought Down the Klan. We're talking about a later lawsuit filed by Morris Dees at the Southern Poverty Law Center against the Klan and how it crippled them. We're talking to Lawrence Lehmer, the author of the book, and you can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about white supremacy, the Ku Klux Klan, Southern justice, you name it. They're all rolled up in here. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So enter Morris Dees at this point in the book. I did not know before this book that he was once a segregationist himself.
Well, he would say that, yeah, I was a segregationist, but so was everybody. That was the very air. If you were a white person in Alabama growing up in the 40s, I mean, you were a segregationist. He had black friends, but in 1958, he was a college student. He was a pre-law student at the University of Alabama. He took off a semester and worked as George Wallace's campaign manager in his first campaign for governor. Now Morris said, "Oh yeah, but Patterson, the other guy, was even worse. Was more of a segregation." That's not true, but that's true. But Morris really was, you know, Wallace was a segregationist and a proud segregationist, and Morris worked for him. And then in 1961, Morris defended the leader of the Klan group that beat up Freedom Riders in Montgomery. And this instance, Morris says, "I didn't know the guy was the Klan leader, and when I later learned that, and I realized it was wrong and it was bad what was done, and I changed." And he did change. He slowly began to evolve. He realized, and you know, it was hard in that climate to change, because people at the time of the when the four black girls were killed in Birmingham and the Birmingham bombing.
Bombing 16th Street. Yep,
bombing Church. Morris was a good Baptist. He was a Baptist. He was like a folk preacher. He'd get up and talk in church. And he went up came to his church that Sunday and got up and said, "You know, we've got some other Baptists in trouble, and we got to help them." And they said, yes, brother. Who are they?" He said, "There was this black church in Birmingham." And suddenly there's absolute silence in the church. They don't want to help these black people. And at the end, Morris says, "Well, let's pray. Let us pray for these black children and for them, and pray to help them." And he shut his eyes on up on the pulpit there. And when he wakes, he opens his eyes. There's nobody left in that church except for his wife.
Wow. That's a bit of a reaction. So I can understand why he ended up wanting to found what became the Southern Poverty Law Center. Why does it have that name?
Well, Southern Poverty, that was meant civil rights law. Now it doesn't seem to have any meaning, because it's really it's a civil rights law firm is what it is. It's the leading civil rights law firm in the South, and now it's a very, very large organization. Then it was just five lawyers, mainly Northerners, and that's another reason it was hated, this idea of these smart aleck Northerners coming down to tell us how to live our lives. But they fought all kinds of lawsuits. They fought to make sure that the roads in Selma, in the black sections of towns, were paved and just weren't dirt. They fought lawsuits to see that the state troopers were integrated. They filed all kinds of lawsuits.
And what kind of scrutiny and attacks did they endure because of their work?
Well, it was the fight against the Klan that brought the most onus. And then the Southern Poverty Law Center was firebombed once. It was firebombed. One time there were two would-be assassins that were outside of Morris's D's ranch. That was at a point where he had protection. He had security. Now, I've had some of my right-wing friends make fun of Morris D's and say he doesn't need security. He's a total fraud. Well, he needs security. I know things have happened within the last year that is darn good thing he has security.
Well, there's a long history here between Morris Dees at the Southern Poverty Law Center and Robert Shelton, who was the Imperial Wizard of the Klan. Give us a sketch of him.
Well, you know, it's interesting because three of the main characters in my book, George Wallace and Morris Dees and Robert Shelton, all had an association with the University of Alabama and the law school. Morris Dees and George Wallace both got their law degrees from the University of Alabama Law School. Robert Shelton was an undergrad. He was a pre-law student in Alabama when he dropped out. He's a smart guy. He could have gotten a degree. For whatever reason, he dropped out, and he becomes a tire worker, and he joins the Klan. He finds a kind of identity in the Klan, and he's a smart and ambitious guy, and he soon is the Imperial Wizard. He's the most powerful Klan leader in America.
And so talk about, you know, George Wallace is one of these figures who comes up over and over again in American history because he certainly was there at a pivotal point. And I've heard, and I worked in Alabama for 2 years myself while he was running for governor in 1982. So I got to hear about the stuff about, oh, he was never really a racist. He just pretended to be that way. What was his attitude toward the Klan?
The Klan they were his supporters. He wanted, in 58, he ran the first time, and Patterson, his opponent, had the United Klan backing, and he denounced the Klan and said the Klan shouldn't be in, that this is totally wrong. But he realized the impact the Klan had, and the Klan would go out. They worked hard. They would tear down your opponent's posters. They would say these things that would provoke people. They were an important resource. So when he ran in 62, he had and wanted the Klan backing. And after that, he got Shelton the contract for the tires for the state, so he no longer was on the assembly line, and he got Shelton's father a job. So he was very, very supportive of him.
Well, and then certainly got support back from, the support worked in both directions. So, but this is, we're talking early 60s by this point, when segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever was one of Wallace's comments. By the time of the Michael Donald murder in Mobile in 1981, who were the people who, how much power did the Klan have by that point?
Well, it was not, it had decreasing power, but there was still, look, in the 20s, as you said, the Portland, the Oregon legislature was controlled. The Klan was there. The governor of Indiana was a Klan member. I mean, even at, right after the Second World War, Senator Robert Byrd, as a young man, was a Klan member. There were lots of powerful people were Klan members then. But by that time, it was the kind of group of, it's a sad group that we see now in the Trump campaign. We see these people that are they don't have any religious affiliation, they don't have any social affiliation, they don't have any unions. They're isolated, and they found the Klan identity and a purpose they could find nowhere else.
It's a gang, in essence.
Yeah.
Lawrence Lehmer is our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. We'll come back and get into the details of the civil suit that Morris Dees filed against the United Klans of America and the results thereof. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Lawrence Lehmer and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Lawrence Lehmer, the author of several books that ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. His latest book is called The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. It's the story of some Klan members in Mobile, Alabama in 1981, angry about a jury not reaching a verdict of guilty on a black man who killed a white man. So they went out and looked for someone, found Michael Donald, killed him, strung him up on a tree in downtown Mobile, and it went on from there. Two men eventually brought to justice for the crime. Morris Dees at the Southern Poverty Law Center went further with a civil suit, which we'll hear about in just a moment. You can join our discussion on The Exchange about the incidents, the events, the power of the Klan and white supremacists then and earlier. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to take a phone call here. Jeannie in Medford, thank you for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, I originally called, about a song by Joan Baez about Lincoln freed the slaves today. But I changed my mind because I remember I lived in Amory, Mississippi, mm-hmm. in 1964. It's near Tupelo. I think I was like 15. My parents, I don't know why we were there. I was about 2 months. And being from California, I was shocked. I walked around town, a little town, and I had a little park with a railroad train parked there. Mm-hmm. And I saw that same sign your guest said, be out of town by dusk. I had never in my life seen such a thing. I thought, where in the heck have my parents moved me to? Thank God we were only there 2 months.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for the observation.
As far as Oregon, I think it's ironic that the word Negro is found in Oregon.
How's that?
N-E-G-R-O and O-R-G-E-N. You can pick out the letters.
Oh.
Oregon was one of the last to get their mind right.
Mm-hmm. True, because we talked about the Klan influence here, and the fact people have talked about Grants Pass once being a sundown town, like what you described in the book, Lawrence, about the sign in Cullman County, Alabama. It is sometimes rather shocking for people who haven't been in the Deep South to understand what goes on there. Where are you from yourself, Lawrence?
I was born in Chicago and then brought up in upstate New York. But in 67, I was a graduate student at the University of Oregon, and I hated everything. I didn't like the study. And I took a course in magazine writing, and I talked my way on George Wallace's plane. And I spent 4 days traveling around Oregon and California with him. And I really grasped that it wasn't just about race. That, again, it was these white working class that felt that their lives are being taken from them, and they identify with Wallace.
And as you say, these are the people who identify with Donald Trump now.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, taking
they're
away
still
your
out
freedom.
There. Mm-hmm.
So let's move into the civil suit here. Talk about Morris Deese and the idea he had of building a case against the United Klans.
Well, look, nobody had ever done this before. This legal theory that you could hold an organization responsible for the actions of a couple of its members, in some ways, is a dangerous idea, right? I mean, you can't. We can say what we want, and we can't hold people responsible. But this is different. These are the leaders tell people to commit violence, and the members do it. That's a different matter. But that was not legal. It was a new idea, and these other lawyers that were at the Southern Poverty Law Center, they thought it wasn't going to work out. First of all, they didn't like the fact that they were living in this armed camp. They had to have security, and there were these death threats. And they didn't like that Morris Deese was spending all his time fighting the Klan, and they thought the suit would go nowhere and be a failure and waste of money and resources. They quit. The entire legal staff quit over this, but he continued, and he had to prove that there was a pattern. He had to prove that there was a pattern of provoking violence, and he got a guy. Thomas Rowe was a FBI informant who had been in the car when Viola Luosa was shot to death in Selma, the time of the Selma March. And he got a deposition from him where he said before he did that, he'd met with Shelton, and Shelton said, you do what you have to do. Now, again, Shelton's too smart to say, go out and murder somebody. He's going to use euphemisms, but that's what he did, and they went out and murdered her. And then there was another Klansman who, a few years later, had his Klan group had gone out and shot up the home of a civil rights leader in the town who wanted to have black people on the police force and the fire department, and shot up the home of a woman who was a white woman who was dating a black man. And these people were sent away to prison, and this young man then he got him to testify in the trial. So he had this, he could show this pattern, and he showed it in the courtroom in 1987 during the trial, the civil trial.
Now, 4 days after Morris Deese filed this lawsuit against the United Klans, Alan Berg was killed. Remind us who he was and how it was related.
Alan Berg was a liberal talk show host in Denver, Colorado. Kind of feisty, intriguing kind of guy that people just like to listen to. And these white supremacists shot him to death in his driveway. And their next target was Morris Deese. And one evening, and Morris Deese, you know, the FBI was on to these people and was on to these threats, and they warned him, and he had his security. He had a guy inside the house, and he had another guy with weapon outside on his property, and at the ranch he lived in outside of Montgomery. And two guys with assault weapons and camouflage equipment came on the property. And, Morris and his daughter, they were decorating the Christmas tree, went in the kitchen and hid in this closet, and these two men were driven off or left.
Wow, so some scary close calls for sure.
Yeah.
And Morris Deese, it sounds like a bit of a free spirit in some ways. You talk about him riding his motorcycle down Alabama country roads at 100 miles an hour. This is not a guy who liked having to be surrounded by, handlers or security.
No, it's not natural to him at all. And, it's funny about his life is because in all those years, people wouldn't talk to him in Montgomery. I mean, his kids would go, they wanted to have a birthday party, and his kids wouldn't come to his house for the birthday party, okay? He just totally ostracized. Go into a restaurant, people turn their backs on him. Now, I hate to go have dinner with him in Montgomery because it takes forever. You go into the restaurant, and everybody wants to say to slap his on the back or say hello and appreciate him, so it's totally different.
Wow. Let's talk about, there's a scene in the book where Morris Deese takes a deposition from Benny Jack Hayes, who we described as the father of one of the killers of Michael Donald, Henry Hayes, and it's hard to come up with a name to describe him that doesn't that we can use on the radio. How much would you have liked to have been in the room when Morris Deese deposed Benny Jack Hayes?
Yeah, I mean, really, but Benny Jack Hayes, was he should have been, if anybody should have been executed, it was him, not his son. Okay, he's the one that provoked his son. He was the one that was behind all this stuff. But he in the end, died before he could be convicted.
What were some of the things that Benny Jack Hayes himself did? I mean, it sounds like he was sort of smart like Robert Shelton. He'd never be caught with a gun in his hand or giving an order to actually kill somebody. But what were some of the things that he got in trouble for?
Well, he actually got in trouble for shoplifting and for he burned down his when his son was indicted for murder. He burned down his house to get money to pay for the defense star. He spent time in prison for that. But what he did was he provoked these young men to do these terrible things. They went out and did what they called missionary work. And the favorite kind of missionary work was to go out and beat up some black person, a black man, okay? And they'd go out and beat him up, you know, really beat him to a pulp. And then right before they left, they'd say, you know, you be quiet about this. You tell the police are our Klan's brothers, and we'll come back and kill you, so you just be quiet.
Well, it is simply hard to imagine for most white people what that would be like.
Yeah.
In the case of Benny Jack Hayes and his own personal demeanor, in addition to the things that he... You talked about how he dealt with the dog and how he tried to goad his son Henry into being more of a man, but
right.
It sounds like even his wife was afraid of Benny Jack Hayes.
I think everybody was afraid of him. His wife said that he had this personality where suddenly he just got out of control. He'd just be talking to him normal, and now suddenly he's just flailing out of his arms and crazy.
So in the process of trying to bring a lawsuit against an organization like the Klan in Alabama in the 1980s, you got to pick your targets carefully. So who did Morris Dees identify as defendants, and what sort of action did the suit seek?
Well, he took all the Klansmen, or the major Klansmen, who had been in the meeting, you know, before when they talked about killing somebody, and the Klansmen after the lynching, a group of them went and burned the cross. He had several of those. He had a half dozen of them, but they were just that wasn't real. That didn't matter to him. They were just sitting there. What he cared about was Robert Shelton representing the Klan. And that's why he sued for $10 million with the idea that he wasn't going to try to get that money from these poor Klansmen, you know, kind of pathetic. He was going to get it to break the Klan. That was the whole focus. And the Klan, in the presence of Robert Shelton, his lawyer, they thought this was a joke. They thought there was no way they were going to be found. They were going to have to pay anything for this. It was just a pathetic joke.
Did they take it seriously at all?
No. And they didn't. They didn't have the legal defense. They could have. They didn't. You know, they didn't come to the depositions. Most of the depositions, and in the courtroom itself, they didn't put up the kind of strong defense they could have, because they thought any jury, they thought the jury might find the individual members guilty, okay, for their responsibility for this murder, but they weren't going to find Robert Shelton and the Klan itself. They were sure that they'd be found innocent,
and that was not what happened, I gather.
No, and one of the keys to it was in the trial, Tiger Knowles testified, and when he testified, it was this bloodless, emotionally denatured way. I mean, it's just like he was discussing something academic that wasn't involved him. The words were good, but not the emotion. And at the end of the trial, last moment of the trial, when Morris got up and made the closing statements, and then Tiger said during the luncheon break, said, "I'd like to come by. I want to talk, Morris. I want to come back and say something else." Well, a lot of lawyers in that situation would say, "You got to be kidding. We've got everything all settled. You've already testified. I don't know what you're going to say. Let's just forget it." But Morris said, "Okay, you can come forward and talk." He didn't even ask him what he was going to say. He just said, "Okay." So in the afternoon, Tiger Knowles got up and he spoke with the emotional power, the way in all these years he'd never spoken before. He said, "I'm so terribly sorry. We did an evil thing here. It's just terrible what we did." And Mrs. Donald was sitting there in front of him. He said, "I'm so sorry, Mrs. Donald. I'm sorry. I deserve any punishment for what I did. I'm so sorry. We did a terrible thing here." And Mrs. Donald looked up and said, "I forgive you, Tiger. I forgive you." And everybody was crying in that car. I mean, even the judge had tears in his eyes.
You said you've visited with Tiger Knowles?
Yes, I have.
Mm-hmm. And is he? Where is he now?
He's in a northern city. Although he plans to go back to Mobile and start a restaurant.
Really?
Huh. He's done very well. He said he saved, and he tried to escape after the trial. The trial that the Klan lost. He thought that because he testified that they'd be able to get a prison early. Well, come on, you committed murder. He spent 25 years in prison, 20 of it in solitary confinement. He got out. He's a good citizen now. He's saved about $250,000, and he wants to take that money down and set a restaurant in Mobile.
Hmm. And Henry Hayes, who was given the death sentence by the judge, what has become of him?
He was executed. Most of the people on death row are black in Alabama, overwhelmingly black. Black people on death, and these are the people he met, and these are the people he spent time with, and he became friendly with, and he changed his attitude toward black people because of this. And the night before he died, he talked to a black preacher, and the preacher said that he admitted then that he'd been the murderer, or one of the two murderers.
What's the general status of the Klan in Alabama now? Is there much of it left?
Well, what the Southern Poverty Law Center, more than anybody, is responsible. We're destroying a lot of these larger racist white supremacist groups. So they're just little kind of groups, like David Duke they're just little groups. And I mean, there's still this pattern of racism. We saw it happen in Charleston with an individual who just picks this stuff up on the internet now. This hate. There are those hateful websites, that's for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So much in the book. It's really rich in history and detail, and not always enough to make you comfortable, but you'll learn a lot from it. The book is called The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. Lawrence Lehmer wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. Lawrence, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take